Alright, this is Braden Sensed, Hanley,
Diana,
Elijah, and Huffy.
Yes.
With Doc.
Doc Mac.
Thank you so much for sitting down with us. I can't say thank you enough for, you know, participating and helping us out.
Thanks for choosing this to be the place to do it.
Always. Alright, so I guess we'll start out with, have you always had the arcade machines at Galvin Ghost set to free-to-play?
Yeah, the free-play idea was originally part of the original business model, and it was for several reasons. Myself personally, going to arcades growing up, I would always bring $20 with me. I would go several times a week, and the downside to having coin-operated machines for me was I was always hesitant to play new games. I wanted to play Double Dragon and Golden Axe and the stuff that I knew and loved, and I would put my money on that. And if I saw a cool game, I would launch the attract mode, and then I would possibly risk putting quarters into it. But for me, it was always, I want people to try new games, and there's so many amazing games that people have never played before. Especially with our selection, we bring so many in from Japan, and if they had to actually risk a quarter, people would be less likely to play them. So having it on free play, it really encouraged people to try something. And if they didn't like it, they could walk on to the next one.
Hmm.
Also, from a business standpoint, first off, the town had a law in place that you couldn't have more than 8 coin-operated machines in any building.
Really?
So the easy way around that is we're not coin operated. So also tax wise, if you're rolling a coin through, it is a coin operated machine, and you then have to pay for a sticker to allow to be your taxed on it.
Okay.
Again, because we're not coin operated, we don't have to pay that tax, which was at a lot of places that amount consistently went up and was. Part of the cause of the demise of several arcades was just that arcade tax. And then games that, because of that, like it would be less advantageous to have specific games that weren't highly profitable, those games would get pulled off the floor. And that's something we never wanted to have. We always wanted to have all of our machines, and going free play was the way to do it. And lastly, especially as we grew, we opened with 130 machines, and we're now at 432. But coin jamming is one of the most common failures on arcade machines. Mm-hmm. So again, going free play, you completely eliminate that. Also, collecting the quarters, it's a whole process that is completely eliminated that we never have to deal with. So all those reasons just made it so, just seemed like the right thing to do. But it most importantly to me was always making sure that everybody was playing new games.
Awesome. I already covered that. And then, so since your arcade library is so large, do you have any trouble accommodating new games, or how do you manage your space?
Space has always been our biggest problem. We just recently did a double expansion, which we used to have 2 party rooms. About 8 months ago or so, 10 months ago, we sacrificed one of the party rooms and turned it into just have arcade games in it. Mm-hmm. We put all of our Mortal Kombat games in there and some shooters. We started doing a fundraiser. The goal was to actually buy out our neighboring building, and we had the building 2 doors down. And the goal was to join all 3 buildings, but we haven't been able to accomplish that just yet. But with the money that we received from the fundraiser, we were able to get a 3rd party room, which we then got rid of our 1 remaining party room and turned that, join those areas into. House about, I think it's about 35 more arcade machines in there, and then also all 9 of our pinball machines. And then we did some construction and cut our back room in half, And that allowed us to bring probably another 35 to 40 machines over from what was our already expansion area and have them on the floor fully accessible all the time. So it really allowed, but now we're at the 432, we're really at max capacity. I have space for maybe two more games, but the downside is I already have 90 more arcade boards that I'm anxious to put on the floor. I just don't have any space. But we are talking with the landlord about putting on a second floor, so that would allow us to have, if we get the middle expansion area, we'd be able to have about another 300 games. If we get a second floor added, we'd probably be able to have about 1,300 more games. So really want to keep growing it and keep expanding, and it's hard to not find it. Like, there's a lot of great arcade games that people are always asking for, so we always try to get whatever we can that people want here. So.
Hey, wow, that's impressive. How do you go about choosing what games you're bringing in? Is it a personal choice? Do you have a team? Or
Initially, it was very much a personal choice. Our first batch of games we picked up out in Iowa, it was this giant warehouse, and they had about 400 machines, and we were picking up about 115 of them, actually 114 of them, and it was all just, I played that, we gotta have that, I love this game, we gotta have it, and it ran like that for a long time. Then it kind of evolved into, because our place is so community driven, we have 30 regulars that are here anywhere between, on the short end, three times a week. Some of them are here every day of the week. They have a lot of games that they want, and usually we use that almost as incentive to do cool things around the arcade. If somebody, like our Gamer of the Year, which is a process of, there's a lot of things that we look at when choosing our Gamer of the Year, but one of the things that we give them is they get to name any game that they want, and we'll bring it in for them.
That's awesome.
But yeah, we get requests from people all the time, and we try to accommodate those. And a lot of times they'll mention a game and they'll be like, yeah, why don't we have that here? And we try to get it. From that, it's kind of evolved into, we've been buying a lot of stuff and importing them from games from Japan. And the more and more that, we work on games here, there's some, the evolution of the hardware has evolved. It's changed so much that I'll buy games specifically to work with that hardware just because I want to see how it works. And I think it's just cool to see the changes and developments that they've made. And then lastly, like, because of our industry friends, that's been a huge motivator of buying specific games. Like, we'll have creators out here that have worked on games, and most recently, George Petro was in, and we were talking with him about Trog and Narc, and we had so many of his great games that he's done, Revolution X, Terminator 2, and he started telling me about how he was working on a game called Dirty Pigskin, football game. And he was like, oh, it was a really small release game, really hard to find, it was so much fun, and he's like, let me know if you ever find one of those. So we spent 2 weeks, and we found one. We drove out to Ohio and picked it up and brought it back. And it's so cool to get, like, the stories behind the games. And we've done that with a lot of the developers, like Brian Colin and Ed Boone. And, like, it's great to just get games that these developers have worked on and see their interaction and hear the stories behind them. And that's because of our production company, that's a secondary huge motivating factor for me to pick what games that we do pick.
Alright, awesome. Then, Ace, you kind of touched on this, but do you have machine maintenance in-house? Do you do it personally, or do you...
We do. It's for the most part, all the maintenance, with the exception of some of the monitors, just because it's an everyday thing. With this many machines, something goes down daily. We had there's one time our worst issue. We had a thunderstorm that messed up our electric, and it knocked down 32 games. And we had 28 of them up and running that day. But it's nonstop. We test everything. We ask our customers to let us know if anything's wrong, and we do all of it in-house. It's basically me and one other guy, Brandon Diaz. We do most of the repairs. Occasionally, again, monitors we send out. Occasionally, there'll be some board work that if it's too tedious and we have so much going on, we'll just send it out. But there's very few places that we trust to do our maintenance outside of our in-house team. So.
All right. What's the busiest time of day or busiest day of the week that you normally have here?
Definitely Saturdays are the busiest. A good Saturday, we'll see over 430 people. But then because of the events that we run, like there's fighting tournaments on Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, and Sunday currently, and we're expanding upon that. Those days, the council area has a lot of action going on. The arcade floor, definitely like Friday evening, Saturday evening. But we get so many large groups that come in together for either just groups of friends or whatever. Like we had two people that came right from their wedding last weekend, and just all their friends showed up. It was like on a Wednesday.
Yeah.
So it's hard to say when it's just because it's so anomalous as to when a big group will show up. But
yeah.
Again, the good part about having so many games is there's always stuff to play, and it's never too crowded here. So
yeah. Awesome. For the fighting games, do you do that on a weekly basis then? Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday, you said?
Yeah, the fighting community is actually separated into several different factions. There's the guys that we support and recognize the most, which is the NetherRealm team. The NetherRealm guys that play Mortal Kombat and Injustice. And there's the anime fighters that play like Guilty Gear, King of Fighters, Blaze Blue. There's 3D fighters for Tekken and Virtua Fighter, and that's definitely a much smaller group. And then there's the Capcom players. So those guys pretty much have their own day. And then our team that we sponsor, right now it's 13 guys. And we send them all over the world to go play in various tournaments and pay their airfare and tournament fees and hotel fees. And they go and represent us, mostly in Injustice. And we have one guy that plays Killer Instinct as well. So, but we are looking at developing more teams, especially with the new Mortal Kombat X coming out. And definitely doing a specific classic arcade team that we hope to send out to other major arcade tournaments.
Awesome. How long have you been in the industry, and what kind of made you decide to go into running an arcade?
Well, I've known that I've wanted to work in the industry since I was really young. Back in the early 90s, I had friends that worked at companies. Back when the 8-bit Nintendo, even when that was coming out, I started doing like hint books for Castlevania. And I had talked with the vice president of Konami about this one book that we had worked on. And they used some of the stuff that, some of the strategies for a thing that they put out, which was really cool. But I was like 8 or 10 years old at the time. So it was very early that I knew I wanted to work in the industry. In 94, I opened up Galloping Ghost Productions, and from there we started doing game design and game development. And we have our Game Dark Presence coming out actually at the start of next year. And that had really given me a lot of connections within the industry. Like from filming that game, we had met a lot of the Mortal Kombat actors and become friends with them over the years. And the arcade was very much, it was something that we were going to open later after our game released. But the opportunity presented itself in 2010. So we just kind of opened it very quickly. It was a very fast process. It was literally almost on a whim just to open it, and just everything fell into place. So
that's awesome. and sorry. How long have you been able to have the high scores posted online?
We started tracking scores probably a few months after we opened. Initially, it was just on our website, and then David Hernley from Orcade heard about a bunch of the events that we were running and the contests, and he flew in from him and Graham, who are pretty much the head guys at David Hernley's the owner of Orcade. They flew in from Virginia and New York to talk to us about scoring. They were very much, they mostly ran scoring with FunSpot. And David Hernley had held, his software basically managed all their tournaments. We really changed it and we're using it on a daily basis. Right now we have 182 world records set at the arcade. And it's almost daily somebody is setting new world records here. And we've had some really incredible ones, and we've had people fly in specifically to set scores just because we do take it so seriously.
And how does that process work? Do they contact you ahead of time saying, hey, I'm interested in coming in and setting a high score, or is it kind of on a whim? Like, how do they, I guess, how is that process set?
It's kind of both. Like we have our regulars that are very focused on scores, and we just recently added camera systems. Usually we would video high score runs that we knew were going to happen, but now we basically have cameras for every one of our players that they can take and set up and record as they go from game to game, should they happen to get a score, just because it's so important to document it. As so many of the older high scores, there's a lot of scores that are questionable. There's scores that they say are world records that are just point wise not possible to do. Like digits will be off, and just talking to some of the players that over the years have set them, you'll hear stories about how there were two scores added together that got that number, and it's been very interesting being so immersed in scoring. But we've had players that, we have one guy that's coming in now from, I want to say he's just driving in from Indiana, but we've had players that come in from Kansas. We had one guy that came in from China, just to put up scores. And it means a lot to people to have their score verified. So it's, and there have been other places. There's a few good scoring houses out there still, but there's definitely been a lot of change in the scene, like especially over the last few years.
Mm-hmm. So, do you ever plan on building a second arcade, or is there anything in the works for that, or?
It's possible. We get requests to open them up all over the place, and right now our main focus is helping. We want to help other people open their own arcades. Mm-hmm. Right now, we've helped 8 other arcades open. Some have just been very short consultations. Some we've really we've helped them learn how to repair machines and find machines and gotten deals on cabinets, and some we help a great deal. And what we really want to see is another arcade like this that is not branded as Galloping Ghost open up and get the same recognition. That would be a true success story for us, and that would help the industry a great deal. Our interest, we definitely would like to open up another arcade, but right now we're so busy on the production end, working on our game that we're putting out, that it's hard to even focus on that between running events, keeping all the machines running, and doing our production work. So a second venue, well, I think it would be very lucrative, especially on the coasts. I think we could do one very well. And even in Japan, like we've sent some of our guys out to Japan to do some research, and it's not being done like we do it, and that's what has left the market so open, and it's why this place has done so well. So,
I guess, how did you come to Brookfield as a place? Like, what made you decide? Was it just fun space or?
I've lived in Brookfield my whole life. Again, because of the production company, I didn't want to have to travel too far. We did check with other towns around here, and there was a lot of negativity about opening an arcade, and we were flat out refused in a few surrounding towns. That there was a lot of old baggage attached to possibly opening an arcade with possibly either gang activity or I know everybody was mentioning like the mafia ties back in the day about, and it's so not like what it was. Like, I've grown up in arcades, I never had any issue, but here it is so community driven, and the players are so like it is completely not like it was back in the day. And the vision of it, now it's starting to change, because the towns that turned us down have since come back and asked us, hey, would you want to open one up here? It's like, no. But it's been so completely helpful to the surrounding businesses as well, because like the motels down the street, people are traveling in from out of town. They're staying at those just so they have quick, easy access to the arcade. Like, we have players that take their vacations here. We have a couple that flies in from Hawaii twice a year. We have a very well-known player, Martin Bedard, who travels in from Canada. He stays for a week. He gets a week pass. He's in open to close every day. And we had one guy in from Barcelona, and it's, again, because we have so many great food places around us and lodging, that it's helped all of those places. The restaurant across the street, they used to close at 11 o'clock, and because we let out at 2, they just stay open 24 hours now. And it's just been great that it's, as a side note, been able to help other businesses, especially from the town that I grew up in. It's been great for the community, which is an added bonus.
Is there one figure in the Chicago coin-op industry that you think everyone should know about, or is it that had a huge impact, at least in your life? Or
as one figure as far as design, or?
I mean, just anything, like whether it be, an important player, important owner, important,
There's so many elements to the scene, and it's hard to just pick one. Like, from an industry of development standpoint, there's just so many. Like, Brian Cullen, George Petro, Eugene Jarvis, Larry DeMar, Ed Boon, John Tobias. It's like everything was made right around here. And the cool thing is that they're so... they're so quick to talk to their fans, and they're really amazed that these games have held up. Like a lot of them didn't even realize the impact that they had on people even to this day. Player wise, we have just some of the best players out there. Guys like Matt Walters, Fred DeHart, James White, Matt Rocco. Each one of them has, I think, at minimum a dozen world records. And you can just see when you come here and talk to them, it's the scoring community here is so different than so many other scoring communities and the fighting community too. Our players are very humble. They're very quick to share information, and it's highly competitive, but it's also very accommodating and friendly and trying to get, it's more about having fun with your friends and setting these incredible world records than it being like a singular head-to-head thing, which is, it's so unique to this place. And it's been recognized, especially in the fighting community, like they've said that the training scene here, like the players, they'll Carl, Perfect Legend, who won Evo, immediately following winning Evo, he came here to train with our guys, which, like, it's incredible. And it's just, again, the community here is not something that you can find elsewhere. And because of all that, the arcade owners themselves, there's been so many great new arcades that have opened, like Logan's Hardware and Underground Retrocade. Like those places, they continue to try to perpetuate arcades, and those guys really stand out. And arcades like Star Worlds, which they've been around for 30 years and have really kind of kept everything going, which, again, it's hard to just pick, if you're like, pick one guy from the arcade scene, it's like, it's just so many, it's so many people.
Yeah. The thing that comes to my mind is, when you were starting the arcade, did you initially think to start with a certain kind of game, like a fighting game, or did you just say, like, we're just going to have a little bit of everything? And, you know, was there a focus on genre, or is it just...
We really wanted to have everything. One of the issues that I always felt, especially with arcades that are opening up now, they focus so heavily on the classics, stuff like 1984 and before. And those are great games, but the evolution of the game player has changed so much. And it's honestly, like, so many of the people love the 90s games. Myself, I was a Sega fanatic. I collected Sega Genesis. I had every commercially released Genesis, Sega CD, and 32X game, and 700 games. And those games meant so much to me and were so playable. Like, the classic games are very frustrating to players, and they're single-player games, so you don't really get the... You can't have, like, a bunch of people come in and all play the same game together and kind of interact. And games like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Simpsons and Terminator 2 and the Mortal Kombat games and Street Fighter, there's so much interaction as opposed to just playing a game like Donkey Kong, where there's a lot of cool personal goals that can be met in that, but you don't get the same experiences playing with your friends. Also, with the classic games, they are incredibly hard. And while everybody loves seeing them, a lot of players, after they play them, they walk away going, well, I'm not very good at video games. It's like Donkey Kong and Frogger. It's like their games are over so quickly that they're not used to that. Like, players that are so used to console games and playing Call of Duty, and where their games have, they've gotten definitely easier over the years. Like, the challenge isn't there, but psychologically, it's almost demotivating to players. And the 90s stuff worked so well, and there was definitely, those games were designed to eat quarters, but again, since we're free play, that kind of is taken out of it. And it's just an interesting situation with that. But when we opened, we wanted to have a little bit of everything. With the exception, the only thing that's really missing from the arcade is probably, like, rhythm games, like Dance Dance Revolution. And it's a huge niche community, but the downside to it is it really imposes upon some other communities. machines have to be very loud. There's super heavy maintenance. Mm-hmm. They definitely work more in a pay-per-play environment than just sitting on free play. So it's the one niche. Until we have space to where we can do it right, we've kind of held off on. But aside from that, shooters, gun games, and fighting games, like, we wanted to have everything.
Okay, interesting. And I guess, again, you've been kind of touching on this throughout this entire thing, but have there been any major arcade machine design changes over the course of the time that you've been working here, and what are they? And, you know, you could touch on that a bit.
Like, as far as...
Are there game design or physical hardware design?
Oh, yeah. Like, it went from, like, in the early days, everything was kind of made proprietary to what they wanted. And then after about 1985, it started to standardize with JAMA, which is, you could literally swap games in and out of any cabinet and just have to reaccommodate buttons or sticks. Hmm. And it's the hardware end of it. One of the most unique, there's some super unique cabinets out there. And it's always interesting to see what developers kind of put their time into make a cabinet look very unique and have unique hardware. Probably none other than, like, Brian Colon, who had done, again, he did Rampage and so many great games. He was really given a lot of freedom to make really cool cabinet designs themselves, and because of that, they had to make more unique hardware. It's now everything has kind of evolved on to where everything is PC driven, and stuff, games like even the new King of Fighters and the new Ultra Street Fighter 4, they're all just PC hardware. Ultimate Arctic Thunder. It's honestly, it's pretty low level PCs that they're running. But it's been an interesting evolution, and there's, again, that's one of the reasons, some games, why we purchase them. Most recently, Galaxy Force 2 was this giant sit down machine that spins around and tilts, and just working on stuff like that has been so much fun. But.
How did you, you talked about it a little bit earlier, but did you always have a knack for the technical side, or is it something you learned as you went along?
Yeah, from the production company end of it, originally I was just some guy that, I like playing video games, and that was about it. And then when I got into game design, it changed the way I looked at games, but then I had to start getting more into computers, and then I got into graphic design and video editing and sound editing and music, and I got into arcade cabinet repair when we had bought two cabinets. This was back long before the arcade. Tore them completely apart, figured out how they worked, rewired them. Changed them into Mortal Kombat machines, and then again, it's all been things that have been interesting to me, and everything has really helped it all work together because of the production company. Like, we've designed cabinets, like our Dark Presence cabinet, we designed it completely from scratch, did all the woodwork, and, like, I wasn't into carpentry up until then, and that helped with the arcade, because now when we need to make a control panel for a specific game, we're able to do all of it in-house. Like, we have all the tools and the know-how to just knock out whatever we need and build it from scratch, which is a huge advantage. Plus, the same thing, it's like with the artwork, we're able to reproduce marquees and bezel art, and just having every facet of the cabinet making, from the software end, it's helped so much in making the arcade, like, just successful, because we can create whatever we need.
So on that note, how often do you find yourself making custom control panels or custom anything?
Almost daily.
Okay.
It's we still work on the evolution of it is like we're getting into 3D printing, like if we need special buttons and stuff, and we're exploring that right now. So it's but yeah, it's pretty much daily that we have to get we do custom artwork, and some of it's fairly easy stuff, but even the connectors that they used to use, like if those don't exist anymore, then we have to like bring in something new that will that can adapt from one to another. It's the fun part of it. To some of the guys here, they find it really challenging and they don't like it. Some of our guy, like the guy who helps me do cabinet repairs, super creative guy. He's also on the production end. He's my lead graphic artist. So it's really cool to just make stuff to get these 30-year-old cabinets to work again. It's the fun part to it. So
that's awesome. Let's see. I guess. What do you consider do you consider there to be a main competition to Galloping Ghost, or if there is, what would it be?
No, it's and that's always been from the outset. It's completely not about. It's not a competition. We want there to be more arcades. We're helping more places open. There's been arcades that Game Grid out in Utah. We heard that one of their games was down, and I've talked to the owner, and I've sent boards out to him. He had a 1942, which was his first game. He was upset that it was down. That happened to be our first game as well. And we had an extra board, so we just sent it to him for free. Mm-hmm. And it's so advantageous to make there be more arcades and share data and share information. We try to be very open, and we never look at it as a competition. We want there to be more arcades, and we want places to have their machines working properly, and it's really the important thing. We currently have the title of the largest arcade in the world, and there's rumors of an arcade opening up out in Tennessee. And it would hurt to lose. I would feel bad if we lost that title, but it doesn't stop me from, like, I'm helping the guy find games and helping him with his business model to open and hopefully be successful. So even if it's with customers too, it's like there's days where our regulars will show up here and we'll be like, yeah, why don't you go to Retrocade today? And we want them to go spread the business around and go. It's important for us because they come back and they're like, "Oh, I played this game out there, and I wish we had it." And it's never a competition though. It's video games. It should all be fun. So,
on one of the points you said, how do you go about finding games or hardware? How did you start with that?
Initially it was really easy because I only had the few games that I owned in my basement. There's an operator that was closing down in Iowa, and we bought 114 games out there, and then they told us they had another warehouse in Tennessee, so we drove out to Tennessee and picked up another 87 games there. It's literally, it's an everyday thing. Like, I spend probably at least 2 hours out of every single day looking at Craigslist and eBay and talking with all my contacts and looking at Japanese websites, because some of these boards are so rare and unique. If something gets posted to Craigslist for 5 minutes, it'll be gone. Mm-hmm. So it's you've got to constantly be checking. It's lately most everything that we've been getting has been coming from Japan. And that it's interesting to see the games that are really popular here, the ones that are out there, they're super cheap. So it's cheaper to actually import them from Japan than to buy them here in the U.S. But you also, you come across games that they weren't released here, and that's true with a lot of our shooters and fighting games, and even some of the classics. Like we, there's a game that came out called Mappy that was really popular in the classic scene. And apparently there's a sequel to it that was only released in Japan that of all the classic players, nobody really knew it existed. So like that's one of the new ones that we're scouring Japan for now, and hopefully we'll be able to bring it in and get people to play games that they've never tried before. And the community has been very generous with us as well. Like last week we received two boards that people just donated to us. We had our Primal Rage 2 board, for example. There's rumored to only be two of those in existence. It's a prototype game that got canceled and Atari went out of business and it was sold off to Midway, like right at that time. And Primal Rage, hugely recognizable game. Nobody ever got to play the sequel. It's not emulated anywhere. It was never put on console. But we have it at the arcade. And that's just due to one of the guys that played here who was very generous. He decided he was going to sell it. He gave it us first shot at it. We came to a price. And now we've had people fly in literally from all over the world just to come play it. And from that, we've been talking with the people that actually worked on it because they never thought that they would see it in an arcade. And it's just been cool stuff like that that happens that it's you never know where the games are going to come from at this point. So,
right. And does your arcade hold any Twin Galaxies records, or how do you, manage between those two, between your scoring system and theirs? Or?
Twin Galaxies, initially, it's changed hands since we've opened. It's changed hands, I believe, 3 or 4 times. Hmm. So many people saw Twin Galaxies as owned by Walter Day in the movie King of Kong. Hmm. And by the time we opened, Walter wasn't, I don't believe at that time, I don't think he even owned it then. We had submitted several scores to them, and they just chose not to acknowledge them. We went through their full process and everything, and for whatever reason, they didn't acknowledge. Our first one that we sent in was Halley's Comet, which was a world record set by Matt Rocco in, I think it was at the very end of 2010. And that score had stood since 1984, I believe. So it was this huge score to come down after all these years. And they just never acknowledged it. Hmm. We tried again with Rostan. Same thing. Sent in all the documentation. Never acknowledged it. The only score... and since then, it just kind of... We started using Orcade, and that's just the scoring house that they acknowledged us. They came to us even, and it worked really well. We stopped submitting them to Twin Galaxies even just because it wasn't worth our efforts. Now, the only score that I think is submitted through Twin Galaxies, I believe, is Caitlin Oliver's Splatterhouse score. When that score was set, it was handled very differently. Actually, the score did not even meet Twin Galaxy standards. They really didn't, like normally there's a full board process that has to be done beforehand, and we did that off camera, like we've had that data already documented, but that was an element that TG just overlooked, and it was an important score, especially for Caitlin. It was very, I believe it was more to get the story than to have it be about the score, because that score actually fell within 24 hours. and was handled the same way. And Anthony Paparo had taken the score back. He was the previous world record holder. And Twin Galaxies didn't acknowledge his score at all. And then Caitlin took it back again, and then Anthony took it back. And it went back and forth. And the score that they did acknowledge, even now, it's not an accurate score. Like, the score has changed, I believe, 6 times. And they don't acknowledge any of those scores. And since that score was taken, Twin Galaxies is under new management, but we haven't had any contact with them so far.
Good. So. Yes, and can you, I guess, describe your experience with Orcaid, or kind of what they are and how they work and how they, you know, relate to you guys?
Sure. Orcaid initially started just as a arcade finder website. And they had not even 100 locations when I started talking with them. Basically, we were driving around with Galloping Ghost Productions. We were doing an initiative called Support Your Local Arcades. And we were really trying to, and this is five years before Galloping Ghost Arcade opened. We were just going to locations to help promote arcades, for the game that we were releasing. We were trying to find places to see who would be interested in buying it. But we were also offering, I wanted to find a place for my guys to go play at, and I could not find a working Mortal Kombat machine. So we were driving around and documenting, like, what arcades and laundromats and bars and pool halls, anybody that had arcade machines. And then we would just upload that data to Orcaid. And we had put in 80 locations in Illinois and Wisconsin. So they kind of took notice right away of what we were doing. And then once we opened the arcade, having such a large amount, they had already had a scoreboard in place at that point, as it was several years later. But since then, like, we have we have four referees at our arcade with Galloping Ghost, and I think there's only, across the U.S., there's only 6 other referees. Oh, wow. So it's still very small. And that's one of the things that we push really hard to help grow. David Hernley's been very accommodating to us as far as, like, when other people are approaching us, hey, we need to get scores registered, and as these new arcades are opening, and we try to help get them involved on Orcaid, because it's a piece of history, like, documenting these scores and these achievements. And again, whoever, there's other scoring houses out there, but Orcaid is, they're strict with their rules, and we actually push to make them even stricter. Like, we ask currently to make it harder to submit scores, because of the stuff that we've seen in the past. Like, we don't want people to become complacent on putting in scores, and like, every score means a lot to at least one person, so it's important to have it all very well documented. But it's Orcaid has been really good. It'll be interesting to see if there's any sharing of information between Orcaid and Twin Galaxies under its new management. So, but at the end of the day, it's all about knowing what the true world record is and having it verified in a very specific way. So,
and how do they decide referees? Does Galloping Ghost hire referees, or does Orcaid send you referees, or
they have to verify who they're allowing? They came out and they talked to me. I'm pretty obsessive about it. Like, I've got every dip switch, like, documented. We're actually going through and making a specific website of ours that you can view the actual board and the dip switch settings, and the dip switches are what control the number of lives and how the scoring works and the difficulties. We're really trying to take it even beyond what Orcade requires. We want to make sure that everything is just bulletproof, and every score here is taken very seriously. And they know that I'm pretty crazy about it, so they've allowed me to, if I train my guys, they can be brought on as referees.
Okay.
So, awesome. And I've helped, like Underground Retrocade, Scott Lambert, he's their referee, Adam Pratt over at Game Grid, there's another guy in Florida that we helped at Arcade Odyssey get their referee in place. And it's, as long as they've got a good understanding and know how to test a game to make sure how the scoring works and what to look for and all the little tricks for scoring cheats, they're if the person is able to pick up on all that, they're all right with it.
Okay. So, it's, just going a little bit more on the production side, you said you initially came into the industry, you know, loving video games and then deciding to produce a video game, right? And how's that, I guess, how's that been handled? Like, how do you...
it's been, especially when we opened, it was very difficult to get into the industry. My goal was, initially, I really wanted to work with Ed Boon. And it was so hard to get into the industry to the point where I was like, oh, well, if I don't, I know I could get into a team fairly easily, but I wanted to have my game ideas in the mix, and that takes a lot of time and a lot, especially now when game budgets are $30 million. Like, it's hard to get any ideas into a game. So we've just started creating our own games. Right now, we had to take a close to a 4-year hiatus from working on Dark Presence. We were supposed to release in 2010, but I got pulled off of working on the game and moved over to fixing arcade machines for close to a year, where I just my team was working on productions. And that was really the big setback with as to why our game hasn't even come out yet. But we're finally managing both, but it'll be probably early next year before we're out. And it'll cause things to evolve again, because most everybody that works the arcade is also on productions. So us going off on our U.S. and world tours are going to cause some interesting changes to happen. So,
I don't know if you're allowed to yet, but kind of describe Dark Presence and
sure.
kind of it is.
It's a 2D one-on-one fighting game, similar to the older Mortal Kombat, but done on a much, much larger scale. We had actually initially approached three of the Mortal Kombat actors to be in our game. The actors had to, we filmed for 4 years, literally every single day for 4 years, trying to get all the movements done. It was shot in 30 frames a second, so the move counts, the frame counts per move is just incredible compared to other games. Like Mortal Kombat was 250 frames of animation per character. The most animated fighting game out right now is probably King of Fighters 13, and those are about 1,400 frames of animation. So there's a huge jump over that 15 to 20 year period. But our characters are clocking in at about 17,000 frames of animation. And we've really designed the game to be hopefully a stepping stone for other companies to see that the arcades are still a viable release market. Games like Street Fighter IV came out, and they were $27,000 per unit, and they only only sold, you needed two units to play the game, and Capcom only sold them in sets of four, which was very difficult for four arcades to afford. And they didn't even release them here in the U.S., which was, in my mind, a huge mistake, because the demand was certainly here. But we really want to, we've added a lot of elements to make the games do very well in the arcade. We've tried to bring a lot of innovation, much like Sega did in the 80s when Sega was really doing arcade cabinets very well. They would make cool games and they would make cool elements that made it, you couldn't really get the full experience at home. And it's been unfortunate that so many games come out and there is no arcade release. It's been one of the saddest things for the Mortal Kombat games for me. And we're hoping that this game will make developers realize that the arcade is still a viable platform to release on. You can make your game back in the 80s. The games did so well because the consoles couldn't handle what the arcades were able to do. So if you wanted to play Double Dragon or NARC, you could play them on 8-bit Nintendo, but they certainly weren't the same as the arcade version. And that's really what we've tried to do. Like data-wise, our game right now is about a terabyte of data. And we've made our backgrounds alone, they're handled in 2D from 3D models, but in doing that, we're able to have them look very high resolution because they're meant to be, like, the characters are live actors, so they have to be incredibly realistic. But because graphic cards aren't fast enough to display our backgrounds on the fly, we had to pre-render them. And another element that we wanted for our backgrounds was we tied a GPS into the actual cabinet, so it looks at the zip code that it's in, and it'll adjust all the weather and time of day. So if it's
awesome.
Nighttime and snowing outside in real life, it's nighttime and snowing in the game. But the downside to that is it ends up, we've had 90 background variations to work with. So it's been an incredible amount of development and production, and we've had a lot of industry people come in and they're like, you guys are nuts for what you're doing here. They're like, you should cut your product. Like, we've been in production since 2005, which is a massive production time. But again, there was the 4-year hiatus in there, but it's kind of changed things, opening the arcade to take more things into accommodation to make it, we want the game to do very well, and the experience of opening the arcade and seeing what little things make arcade games better or worse is, we've been able to shift up a few things and redesign a few elements to Dark Presence, so we're anxious to get it out in front of people.
Is with it releasing in 2015, which I must assume feels good to actually finally have it.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Do you think you'll be making more games after this? Do you think you're going to continue on with that?
Absolutely. We had already, and one of the reasons why we were in the filming studio for so long is we filmed the sequel at the same time, which was Conquering Light. So we already have that that will probably be done within a year. And that already we've had interest from Microsoft about doing a console release. So it's, and then we've got at least a dozen more games that we want to do on various platforms, not just arcade, but it's definitely something that we look to expand on and even combine with the arcade a little bit more. We do teach game design and game development here. And initially we had our green screen set up in the back room, although we didn't film our game here. But the idea was to allow people to come in and film their own characters, and then we would teach them how to use our tools and our game engine, which is all proprietary to Dark Presence, but we would make another new game for the arcade floor, just with whoever wanted to learn that here. They would be in a video game here at the arcade, so...
So do you continue on with that kind of a practice, the education aspect of it? Are you currently in that?
Absolutely. We do, on the game development thing, it's definitely been a little slow, but we've brought people in to intern and work with us who they don't work for us, but we teach them 3D and music. And one of the main important parts to game design is the programming tools. And we've given people our tool documentation just to see all the little things that you have to keep track of. And like, it's been well received. We've had a lot of people come in, just to talk about it. We teach other stuff, even down to wiring arcade cabinets. We've held, I think, 5 or 6 full, like, we do events with them. And one of the cool things, we've had people from other arcades show up to learn how to fix their arcade machines. And even Scott Lambert, him attending one of those wiring classes that we had, it was one for wiring an arcade cabinet from scratch. He walked away, he came up to us after, and he was like, "You make it look really easy." It's not super complicated once you know all the tools and you're able to work with everything. But he's like, "I want to open an arcade, I think." And seeing how the maintenance that's involved, I think I can do it. And then from there, that evolved into another arcade opening, and that's the Retrocade. And so it's cool being able to teach stuff and people just it expanding the within different elements of the industry. So that's been very rewarding.
Very well. Yes, lastly, is there anything that we didn't touch on that you want to let people know about, or
not really. I guess our big thing here, we always try to keep everything up and running and keep adding new games and try never to take anything off the arcade floor, because every machine over there is somebody's favorite. So it's we just hope to keep getting bigger and keep growing and help the industry however we can.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.